Welcome to Throwing Mountains Weekly Strength. I'm your host, Chris Bollinger. For the next 13 or 14 minutes, we're going to draw strength from the Bible. I encourage you to make this a daily practice on your own. This is our next to last week in Big Topics. This week's big topic is teamwork. The Bible passage for this episode is a long one. It's 1 Corinthians 12, 12 to 27. I'll read it from the ESV, the English Standard Version. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as He chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor. And our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Now you are the body of Christ, and individually, members of it. One of the things that I have always appreciated about the Bible is that it tells real stories of real people. You know the stories are real because they present not just the good sides of people, but also their bad sides. You know the people are real because, with the exception of Jesus, they were ordinary people, very ordinary people. Sometimes they were even complete knuckleheads. Let's consider two of these people. The first is Abraham. Father Abraham, the patriarch of God's people, the father of many nations. God told Abraham to leave his home and go to a place that God had chosen for him. So Abraham set out with his wife Sarah, his nephew Lot, and others. There was a famine in the land, so they were forced to go to Egypt. When they got there, Abraham told Sarah that because she was so beautiful, the Egyptians would kill him so they could have her. So he told Sarah to pretend that she was not his wife, but only a sister. Pharaoh gave Abraham many gifts, but when Pharaoh tried to take Sarah as his wife, God afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. Pharaoh was furious with Abraham for lying to him and sent Abraham and Sarah away. Years later, when Abraham and Sarah traveled through Gerar, he did exactly the same thing with Abimelech, the king of Gerar. This time, God came to Abimelech in a dream and told him that Sarah was Abraham's wife. Once again, a king was furious with Abraham for lying about Sarah, but gave Abraham many gifts and let him leave quietly. Lying about your wife once? Okay. But twice? That's knucklehead territory. The second person is David, King David, the slayer of Goliath, a man after God's own heart. As the king of Israel, he had everything, God's blessings beyond what he could have imagined as a shepherd boy. The adulation of the people, multiple wives, you name it. But one spring, when he was supposed to be leading the armies of Israel in battle, David decided to stay home and, well, basically, hang out. After napping one afternoon, he went up on the roof and spied on a beautiful woman, Bathsheba, bathing at another house. He found out that she was the wife of one of his loyal soldiers, a man named Uriah, who was away at battle. So what did the great King David do? He summoned Bathsheba to his royal home and slept with her. A few weeks later, she sent word to him that she was pregnant. So then what did David do? he told the commander of his army, Joab, to send Uriah to him. When Uriah came, David told him to go home, hoping that Uriah would sleep with his wife and think that he had gotten his wife pregnant. But Uriah refused to go home, so David had him killed. He sent these orders to Joab: set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. Once Uriah was dead, David married Bathsheba. Stories such as these don't just make the Bible more believable, they also demonstrate that God can use anyone to accomplish his purposes. With God's help, ordinary people can do extraordinary things, but they rarely do those things as individuals. More often, they accomplish great things as part of a team. A team can be as few as two people. In the beginning, God created the first human being, a man named Adam. Then God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." God took one of Adam's ribs, made it into a woman, and brought her to Adam. And Adam said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." It was the first team, a team of two. Solomon noted in Proverbs 27:17 that just as iron sharpens iron, one man sharpens another. When Jesus sent out his disciples without him, he sent them out in teams of two. Jesus picked his teams, and if you're married, you picked your wife, but often you don't get a say in who your teammates are. Sometimes you don't know them very well or know them at all. That was the case for the crew of Apollo 13. They didn't know most of the people at Mission Control in Houston, but the team there turned what could have been a complete and total disaster into what became known as a successful failure. Everything was fine at launch. Well, almost everything, as you can hear in this clip from the film.
Houston, this is 13. We've got a center engine cutoff. Go on the other four.
Roger that, 13. We show the same.
Booster, can you confirm that center engine cutoff?
Roger that, flight. Looks like we lost it.
Fighter, what's that going to do to us?
Stand by, flight.
I need to know if the IU is correcting for the number 5 shutdown.
Houston, what's the story on engine 5?
Right, looks good. We're still go.
We'll be all right as long as we don't lose another one.
Roger that.
At 13, we're not sure why the inboard was out early, but the other engines are a go, so we're just going to burn those remaining engines for a little bit longer.
Roger that.
Our gimbals are good. Our trim is good.
Looks like we just had our glitch for this mission.
A little over 2 days later, as the spacecraft was nearing its lunar orbit, a routine maintenance task became anything but routine.
We got a couple of housekeeping procedures for you. We'd like you to roll right to 060 and null your rates.
Roger that. Rolling right, 060.
And then if you could give your oxygen tanks a stir.
Roger that.
Suddenly, everything went wrong.
Hey, we've got a problem here.
What did you do?
Nothing. I stirred the tanks.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a main bus B undervolt. We've got a lot of thruster activity here, Houston.
Now?
It just went offline. Oh, there's another master alarm, Houston.
I'm checking the quad.
Christ, that was no repress valve.
Maybe it's in quad C.
We've got a computer restart.
I'm going to reconfigure the RCS.
We've got a pink light.
Where these things fire, it doesn't make any sense.
We've got multiple caution and warning, Houston. We've got a reset restart.
All right, I'm going to SDS.
Stirring the craft's two oxygen tanks caused one of the tanks to explode. The explosion damaged the other oxygen tank and destroyed two of the craft's three fuel cells, which provided electricity and potable water to the astronauts. No one knew the extent of the damage. All they knew was that they had lost most of their power and were losing oxygen at a rapid rate.
I don't know. Maybe this is a caution and warning failure.
Houston, we are venting something out into space.
I
I can see it outside of window one right now. It's definitely a gas of some sort.
It's got to be the oxygen.
In a very short amount of time, all the breathable oxygen would be gone, and the astronauts would suffocate. Their lives were completely in the hands of the men at Mission Control, 200,000 miles away. NASA flight controllers and engineers had to find a way to keep the astronauts alive and get them home. Houston started by ordering the crew to move from the command module, Odyssey, to the landing module, Aquarius, which had enough oxygen for 4 days, at which point they could transfer back to the damaged Odyssey for re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. Engineers told the crew to turn off all non-critical systems to reduce energy consumption and to save water for cooling Aquarius's overtaxed hardware. When too much carbon dioxide started building up in Aquarius, Mission Control devised a way for the astronauts to build air filters out of plastic bags, cardboard, tape, canisters from Odyssey, and even an old sock. Two more huge hurdles remained. First, doing a burn to adjust their trajectory back to Earth, and second, powering up Odyssey. Because there was no guidance computer in Aquarius, the burn required a concerted effort by the three astronauts and the team in Houston. The proper power-up sequence was devised by astronaut Ken Mattingly, who was scrubbed from Apollo 13 because he'd been exposed to measles, and engineer John Aaron. The team at Mission Control had done an amazing job. But as Odyssey finally entered Earth's atmosphere, everyone recognized that the overall mission still had not been achieved and might not be.
Like, they're still shallowing a bit up there. Do you want to tell them?
Is there anything we could do about it?
Not now, Flight.
And they don't need to know, do they?
Copy that.
It's just my phone still a presence in the splash down here?
Yeah.
Here we got the parachute situation, the heat shield, the angle of the trajectory in the typhoon. There's just so many variables, I'm a little lost.
I know what the problems are, Henry. This could be the worst disaster NASA's ever experienced.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Gene Kranz was right. You are a vital, even indispensable, part of the body of Christ. And so am I. And so is every other Christian on the planet. We're all members of the most important team ever assembled. That team can't function with division. All its members need to work in harmony to accomplish the strategic goals that our coach has set for us. To butcher a quote from Vince Lombardi, when it comes to the body of Christ, teamwork isn't everything, it's the only thing. Next week, I'll look at the last big topic in our series. Time. I hope you'll join me for that. Please pick up a copy of 52 Weeks of Strength for Men. You'll find it to be a good resource on this journey. Have a good week, men.